Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Don't be surprised if you run into a lister in your neighborhood sometime soon. A lister is one of over 40,000 people assigned to check addresses for the 2020 census. They're making sure the Census Bureau's list of addresses is correct before any forms are mailed out next year. Between now and October, listers all across the country will be tasked with verifying some 50 million addresses. And that's because there's a lot at stake. The decennial headcount determines who gets hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding for everything from healthcare to education. It also determines the number of U.S. House seats allocated to each state and even determines the boundaries of voting districts. So joining us with more on the local census operation and why it's so important is Fernando Armstrong, Regional Director of the Philadelphia Regional Office of the Census Bureau. In addition to the tri-state area, the Philadelphia Regional Office serves nine states, including Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee. So if you've got questions about the census, give us a call at 888-477-9499, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Fernando Armstrong, welcome to Radio Times Regional Roundup.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you. What exactly will the listers be doing?
The listers will be confirming that the address file we have for the country is reliable, is complete. These addresses can receive mail because come March of next year, we're going to be doing a series of mail-outs to the whole country, inviting them to be part of the census, to go online and do what they need to do to be part of the 2020 census.
So this is really the first phase
Correct.
Of a larger operation.
Correct.
How is technology changing the way the census is being carried out?
It's helping in a big, big time. It used to be way back when I started doing this 41 years ago. Everything had to be done on paper. There was a register, there were maps, there were forms. I had forms all over my living room when my children were small. Nowadays, it's a laptop, and the laptop will have the maps, will have the listing of the addresses that need to be verified, will have the manual, the directions people have to follow. So technology is helping in many, many ways. In 2020, next year, when we're asking the public, the country, to reply to the census, technology will help again. People can do it online. We are encouraging the majority of the people to go online and do the census. People can pick up their phone and do it by calling an 800 number, and there will be on the other end of the phone, there will be people that will assist them in language. And then finally, if all that is not acceptable to people, they can still do the paper form like we have done in the past. So we are in 2020, there will be many options for people to be on the census. And because of the importance of the census, we want people to take advantage of all these options to be part of it.
And you mentioned the phrase in language, so meaning that it will be available in multiple languages.
Correct, 12 languages. People will receive assistance in 12 languages, and there will be other documents that will help in 40-some additional languages. Hmm. So there is no reason for people not to be on the census. I think it's a moment we have once and only once every 10 years. And I think all of us need to take advantage of it.
And I want to talk about the reasons that that's important in just a moment. But getting back to having people fill out the forms online, it raises several questions. First of all, there are people who don't have internet access, and it sounds like you have some other ways of getting around that by phone, by filling out the forms and all of that. For those who do, though, a couple of things. One, there's the question of cybersecurity and people being concerned that their personal information may be compromised. How is the Census Bureau approaching that?
We have been testing this process for the last 7 or 8 years, and every time we address those concerns, there are many, many actions, many decisions, many improvements that have been put in place to protect the confidentiality of the information, to protect the system itself so that it cannot be hacked. We are in consultation with other federal agencies that are experts at these kind of issues, and they have been advising us and helping us get a very, very, very secure, very safe system. So I tell people, you give to your grocery store or to your library a lot more information than you do on the census. So there is no reason to be concerned.
What are the kinds of questions, or what's the kind of information that people will be asked when they fill out the form?
It's very basic. It's their name, their address, of course, their date of birth, the relationship between the different members of the family, their age, their gender. So it's very, very basic information. There is no longer a long form. All that is part of the American Community Survey. So there is no reason for people not to be able to answer these 10 or 11 questions, and then it takes 10 minutes.
So not too long. For those who do have internet access, how do you incentivize them to actually go online and get it done?
There are many. In 12th of March of next year, we're going to be sending out the invitations to people. When you do it online, it's very quick. It's no one has to come to your door. No one has to call you. You don't have to wait for a form, a paper form, to arrive in your mailbox. So as you're waiting for your turn at the barbershop or the nail salon, or you are waiting at a game to start, you can go online and do it. So it's quick, it's safe, it's easy, and most of all, it's extremely important because, as you said, the census determines our representation in Congress, and every year about $675 billion are allocated back to the community based on formulas that use the census. So where a school is built, whether it's an elementary school or a middle school, where a hospital is built, where roads are necessary, where grocery stores are established, all that is depending on a very accurate census.
Yeah. Fernando, there has been, as you well know, a heightened level of fear around the census, particularly in communities of color, in communities with large immigrant populations because of fear of deportation and all kinds of other things. What is the Census Bureau doing to address that kind of fear, particularly in those communities, and to establish a level of trust where people would be willing to be counted?
Yeah, we are doing a number of things. We are going out, talking to the community in many different ways and reassuring them that the census is safe. There's no law enforcement agency. There's no local or federal agency that has any access to the information we collect. They should be able to trust us. We are working with churches, with schools, with the media. We're working with many partners that we have throughout the community to help us get the word out about the importance of the census, the fact that it's confidential, the fact that it is safe, it is not shared with anyone. All we produce are statistical summaries where we cannot identify particular people. It's just a summary. So I encourage the public, I encourage your listeners to be looking forward to the moment when they can be part of the census in 2020.
You mentioned schools and churches and working with community groups. Is that part of the Trusted Voices?
Absolutely.
Effort?
Absolutely. We know that there are people that are far more effective in getting the word out and getting the trust of the community. We know that churches are an excellent way of getting the message out. We know that our elected officials are a fantastic way of getting the message out. So we are reaching out to them. We're bringing them on board to come and get the communication to the public. There is a large communications campaign that starts in January of 2020, and it will be very, very extensive, and it will get the message out in many different ways about the importance of the census and that it's safe, it's confidential, and it's good to be part of it.
We have an email here from Casey. It says, wouldn't it be more efficient and accurate to combine the census effort with annual income taxes? Every head of household could report census data for their household on their 1040.
Well, there are other administrative records that we use from other federal agencies to educate our way of reaching out to the community. But the Constitution and the census is mandated by the Constitution. It requires us to go and count people in person or through the emails or through the internet. There, we have to contact each address. We need to make sure that the people, when they are counted, are also placed in the right geography, because that is what determines the congressional districts, the redistricting at the local level. So, yes, we are using other agencies' records and information that they can share with us. We don't share anything back with them, but we still need to make that contact with the households.
Fernando, that leads to a question about the scale of this operation, because as I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking about the fact that the Philadelphia office alone is responsible for 9 states. You've got 40,000 plus people hitting the streets today with laptops to verify 50 million addresses. Can you talk a little bit about what it requires to be able to get the most accurate headcount possible just from the Philadelphia regional office alone?
It requires a lot of effort. We have opened 36 local offices in these 9 states. They are being staffed with management. They are recruiting and conducting training of those listers. Every one of those individuals canvassing the addresses will have an electronic device, a laptop. Next year, when we do follow-up to the addresses that have not replied to the census, everyone will have a smartphone to do that. So there is it's a very, very large operation. Hopefully, we will get the public to participate, to respond to the census online. And the more they do that, then the fewer people will need to send out to knock on doors. Our goal is not to have thousands of people going out knocking on doors. If we can get people to reply online or to pick up the phone or to do the paper form, then it's a lot faster, a lot less expensive.
Fernando Armstrong is the regional director of the Philadelphia office of the Census Bureau. Thank you so much for helping us understand the importance of the census and how all of it is going to be carried out. When Radio Time's regional roundup comes right back, we're talking about climate change and why it's hitting the Garden State particularly hard. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. As the national debate over climate change rages on, temperatures in America are rising at an alarming rate. Perhaps nowhere is that more true than in New Jersey, where the average temperature has risen about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius. That is double the national average. The increase in temperature is creating havoc across the Garden State. Insects that normally die when the mercury falls are living longer and attacking people and crops, and that's just the beginning. Lake Hopatcong, New Jersey's largest freshwater lake, is kind of a case study in what happens when temperatures climb too high for too long. Most of the lake remains closed to swimming and fishing because of a toxic bacteria that grew in the lake after a warmer than normal spring. Lake Hopatcong is the centerpiece of a recent analysis in the Washington Post entitled 2 degrees Celsius, extreme climate change has arrived in America. It is a sobering portrait of the consequences of climate change and a warning of what's to come. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guest today is Juliet Eilperin. She is one of the authors of that report. She's the Washington Post's senior national affairs correspondent covering the transformation of federal environmental policy. Juliet, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
So why is it that New Jersey's temperatures in particular have risen at a rate that is double the average for the lower 48 states?
Well, it's actually important to note that this is actually a generally a northeast trend. So while, you know, absolutely New Jersey is close to 2 degrees C, Rhode Island has already surpassed that mark, and then you have a handful of other states, including Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts, that are also almost around that mark. So while New Jersey is rising, you have others as well. And there are a couple of factors that are raising the temperatures in New Jersey and some of the surrounding states. One is the fact that there are warmer winters. So what we've seen is while the elevation of temperature is occurring year-round, what we're seeing is a particular rise in winters. For example, the average temperature in New Jersey is from December to February is now above 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature at which water freezes. And what we've also seen from talking to the state climatologists is you've seen so many warm months that since 2000 there have been 39 months that are warmer than the historic average and none that are colder. So when you have warmer winters, that's raising the temperature overall. It's reducing snow cover, which actually reflects back solar radiation, and so that's contributing. A second very important factor is the warmer water offshore, and we've been seeing this really affecting states like New Jersey with a significant coastline and Rhode Island and other places, where what's happening is you have warmer water offshore, you have a slowing in the Gulf Stream, which is keeping some of the warmer water that usually moves back in the Atlantic towards Europe. And that is also accelerating warming. And so all of these factors are really changing the environment in the Garden State.
So how did you and the team of reporters that you worked with conduct this analysis? How did you all come to focus on Lake Hopatcong in particular?
That's a good question. What happened is once we found out that that the temperature was warmer in New Jersey and these surrounding states, and frankly, that, you know, that surprised us a little when we started looking at this. It's not like we thought that the Northeast was the region of the country that was warming the fastest in the contiguous U.S. We then started calling around and trying to find out, well, how is this affecting different aspects of New Jersey? How is it affecting agriculture? How is it affecting the environment? And so it was really by reaching out to a series of folks, including scientists, you know, again, folks in the farm industry, a whole range of folks that we came to see Lake Hopatcong as significant. And it's actually worth noting that we started doing this reporting before, as you noted, you had this explosion of blue-green algae that's caused much of the lake to close. That wasn't initially why we focused on the lake. We focused on it because it had been literally the ice factory for New York City and the surrounding area, you know, at the start of the 20th century. And the fact that it no longer reliably freezes through, we thought was a really powerful illustration of how much the environment in New Jersey has changed over the last century.
I thought it was fascinating that you describe at the very outset of the article that in, say, 1926, I think the year was, that you could drive automobiles onto the lake because it was frozen that thick. That's just an amazing comparison to today and the fact that it may not freeze at all or is quite thin.
It's really incredible. I mean, you know, one thing that's amazing that we found, another colleague, Steve Muffson, who's proud New Jersey, born and bred, native, he went up to the lake, and they have this great museum there because, again, this is, you know, an iconic, it's man-made, but it really, you know, is hugely important to this area in New Jersey. And so they had these incredible file photos. We started was looking through it and talking to folks and saw these pictures. And it's exactly what you said. You know, you look at these pictures and you see the winter carnivals and these old-fashioned, you know, lakes on – I mean, old-fashioned cars on the lake. And you really get a sense of how radically things are different. And I think that's something that it's kind of hard to take – measure of unless you can see it for yourself, for your own eyes.
So the blue-green algae that you mentioned in that analysis that has caused a large part of the lake to shut down, I think some portions have reopened, but not too many. What are the
right.
health risks that are associated with that? I mean, what is the issue with the algae? What is it and why is it dangerous?
Well, it's really toxic bacteria, and so essentially it can sicken people. It's when you're swimming and you're obviously gulping in water and things like that. There are also weeds that have proliferated, again, that normally would have died out, but instead have expanded, and that becomes a swimming hazard as well. That's not it's not why the lake shut down. It's another problem that's directly linked to climate change that has impeded the kind of traditional tourism that they've had there. And you're absolutely right. The last week when our story came out, the entire lake was shut down. Now a portion of it has opened, although the majority of it is still closed. And really that's, you know, been devastating to the local tourism economy that this lake depends on and sustains.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the economy. I'd like to talk about that because you mentioned toward the end of the analysis that this is clearly not just an environmental problem, that businesses are feeling the impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, again, just when we learned that the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection had closed it down, you know, again, we checked back to see what was happening and talked to John Clark. He's the co-owner of Little Nicky's Italian Restaurant, which is right, has a lakefront view. And it does nearly a tenth of its business over the first two weekends in July. And the right before July 4th, it's usually extremely crowded. People do swimming, you know, wading, water sports on the lake. And it's a place where, you know, they're obviously always looking for a bite to eat when they're taking a break. And what Mr. Clark told us is that there were only three people the afternoon before July 4th, and he estimates that he's lost half of his business compared to usual. And so that has a huge income for, you know, these places that require kind of an active summer tourism season to sustain their business year round.
Right. And that's just one of many businesses in the area. So
absolutely. You know, you talk about like the hotels where people stay. I mean, there are these huge ripple effects that happen that people, again, might not connect with climate change, but we're seeing them in real time.
You're listening to WHYY, to Radio Times Regional Roundup, and we are talking with Juliet Eilperin. She is a Washington Post correspondent and one of a group of authors of an analysis on climate change and how it is impacting the country, particularly the Northeast. Juliet, what about the Pine Barrens? How are they being affected?
They're being affected by beetles, that beetle infestations. I've spent time hiking in the Pine Barrens. It's obviously an incredible place. And what you're seeing is pine beetles, which have really proliferated, for example, out west in the Rockies. People think of that. They can be devastating for forests. And what we have been seeing with these beetles is that they've essentially been making their way into the Northeast, and they're transforming forests. They're, you know, killing swaths of the forests where people, you know, again, are used to seeing healthy trees. And so that, you know, many of the kind of pests are the real winners we're seeing here, you know, in New Jersey and other places, as they, you know, they normally would have died off, over the winter. But instead, if they're warmer, they thrive, and then that allows them to do greater damage during the warmer months.
Your analysis shows that a number of other parts of the country are also showing strong warming signals besides just the Northeast. What are some of the major hotspots according to the data that you've gathered?
Sure. And now it's worth noting that, of course, Alaska is the ultimate hotspot, which, you know, as with the rest of the Arctic, is, has already warmed more than 2 degrees C. Then across the U.S., what was really interesting is we looked at data from 3,107 counties of the entire lower 48 and found that you have a whole range of spots, some which you might expect, like a number of along the Canadian border, you have a group of counties stretching from eastern Montana to Minnesota. But you also have high-altitude deserts in Oregon. There's a stretch of the western Rockies, which, of course, has the snow melt there feeds the Colorado River. And there are also some counties along the northeastern shore of Lake Michigan, as well as in southern California in the L.A. area.
And what about population in those areas? I mean, is there a way to know how many people are living in the areas that are experiencing the increased warming?
Absolutely. We crunched the numbers, and it's 34 million Americans, that's 1 in 10, are living in these 2C counties, as we say. But this is partially because it includes New York City and Los Angeles, which are obviously so populous. But it really, you know, it really is pretty extraordinary. There are 71 counties across the country that have reached this mark. But because you have really populous areas, whether it's Long Island, L.A. or New York, that gives you a disproportionate number of Americans that are living under these conditions.
Yeah, that is a huge number. Why is it that 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 Fahrenheit, why is that sort of the magic number as it relates to climate change?
Right. And now, this is a number that was it was actually picked a quarter of a century ago when nations from across the world, almost every nation on Earth, gathered in Rio de Janeiro to kind of establish what was the global temperature tipping point that they were obligated to avoid. And so at that point, scientists said, we really need to avoid having a temperature rise of 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, compared to pre-industrial levels, because at that point, you could really have planetary changes that would wreak havoc. And so we're talking about massive melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet, widespread die-off of coral reefs, potential shifts in ocean currents and the Gulf Stream, which could really disrupt temperatures. So that was why they picked that mark. It's worth noting that in recent years, given what scientists have discovered, there's a broader consensus that 1.5 degrees Celsius may be the global tipping point that we really want to avoid. But at this point, we have this number. And so while on a regional scale, it doesn't mean the same thing to reach this mark, but we thought it was a very helpful indicator of where the world was going and what this means. And so that's why we picked 2 degrees C.
I was curious in the report that you mentioned that Pennsylvania is the only state in the Northeast that has not seen average winter temperatures rise by that, 3.6 degree Fahrenheit number over the last 124 years. Is that because we're further inland, or why is it that Pennsylvania maybe has not experienced warming to the same degree?
Right. It's quite interesting. Basically, we just discovered these numbers in recent months, and we started reaching out to scientists. And of course, while they were aware broadly of these trends, they're actually trying to figure out now what accounts for some of this. I think you're onto something when you say it's because Pennsylvania is broader, is further inland. And so that's absolutely part of it. I don't think it's receiving the same warming influence from offshore. It's also obviously such a vast state. So when you have a broad state with temperature variations, it can smooth out the curve. When you look historically, you've had a rise of nearly 1 degrees C or 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit in the state as a whole, which basically puts it on par with the rest of the United States. There are certainly hot spots. That includes Philadelphia County and Lancaster County that have warmed not 2 degrees Celsius, but they're closer to it. So I think there are a number of different factors, but it is very interesting that Pennsylvania was absolutely the outlier in our analysis.
And speaking of outliers, and I'm not sure if I'm using that word the right way in this context, but your data show that the South is the only region that has not seen significant warming, and that, in fact, there may be some evidence of modest cooling in some parts of the South. So how are scientists accounting for that?
Well, that's a good question. So they call this a warming hole, and you're absolutely right that there have not been the same temperature rises. You know, there hasn't been the same temperature spike in the South, and particularly Mississippi and Alabama have had some slight cooling. And so they think there are a couple of factors that account for it. One are just kind of atmospheric cycles that are driven by the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. There's just certain cycles that affect, you know, that region of the country, and they think part of that is one of the reasons there hasn't been the temperature rise. A second reason is human-caused. That's the smokestacks that, you know, took longer to clean up in, you know, in this region where there was a heavy reliance on coal. It actually, when you put soot into the atmosphere, it has a cooling effect. It actually blocks some of the sunlight coming in, and so that is also most likely a reason why it has not warmed as much as the rest of the country.
That's fascinating. So here's the $64 million question. If nothing changes, temperatures continue to rise around the globe, and certainly we're focusing on the U.S. and in particular the Northeast, what kinds of consequences are we likely to see?
Oh, it's clear that there are dramatic consequences. I mean, again, think about that there. So there are basically 20,000 acres of the Pine Barrens have been destroyed by the infestation of beetles so far. Think about if that rises exponentially. You know, that's just, you know, something there. We've seen huge changes again in crop yields in places like New Jersey and elsewhere. But broadly speaking, we're talking about enormous shifts in the landscape and conditions people are living in. You know, we're seeing heat, you know, incredible heat waves across the country. I mean, across the world. Obviously, July was recorded as the hottest month recorded in human history just this past July. So, and you know, we saw what devastation that brought, as well as accelerated melting in places like Greenland. Our Arctic sea ice is, you know, at a dramatic low right now. So we're talking about huge shifts that could lead to, for example, mass migration in part of the world, as well as just, you know, changes in how people live their lives. The U.S. is among the nations best equipped to adapt, but there are plenty of other places that are going to be much more, much harder hit.
Well, Juliet Eilperin, we have to say goodbye, but I want to thank you so much for that report. It really helped us to understand what is at stake here and what is happening not only in our region but around the country. Thank you so much for what you've done to help us understand that.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Juliet, again, is the Washington Post's Senior National Affairs Correspondent. When Radio Times Regional Roundup comes right back, we will be talking about a project going on at the Eastern State Penitentiary where every night for the next few weeks, prisoners' animated films will be projected on the walls of that prison. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. If you happen to go by the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia's Fairmount section any evening between now and mid-September, you just might catch a movie playing on the former prison's dramatic stone walls. Those walls once housed the likes of notorious bad guys like Willie Sutton and Al Capone. Today, they house a museum dedicated to deepening the conversation around criminal justice reform. The Hidden Lives Illuminated Project is a compilation of animated films created by incarcerated artists who live behind the walls of Pennsylvania's prisons. The films will be projected onto the exterior walls of Eastern State Penitentiary every night until September 12th, and the goal is to shed light on the lives of those behind bars and spark conversation about criminal justice reform. Joining us with more on the project is Eastern State Penitentiary Senior Vice President Sean Kelly, who also serves as project lead, and Erica Suchia, who is the lead teaching artist for the project. You can join the conversation by calling us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sean and Erica, welcome to Radio
Thank
Times.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That's great to be here.
So, Sean, where did this idea to have prisoners tell their stories in this way come from?
We were inspired by a project out of Chicago. The artist Damon Locks, working with Sarah Ross and the artist Maria Gaspar, did a similar project. I was in Chicago. Our director of education, Lauren Zalit, and I were in Chicago studying. We were getting ready to hire formerly incarcerated people onto our staff. We hire people who've been incarcerated onto our education staff. And so we were studying how other places had done similar work. And we were in Chicago and heard that there was this program going on where animated films by people living in prison were going to be projected on the outside walls. And so we went and saw that. And there's something magical about the combination of animation and people who are incarcerated, because, of course, people who are incarcerated can't use cameras, they can't leave and go to set, but all of the aspects of filmmaking are available to someone making an animated film, but you can do it all from very limited environment, like inside of a prison. And so with the blessing of those artists, we came back to Philadelphia and started thinking about a project that's similar and inspired by that one. Ours turned out to be very different, but its DNA still is definitely from Chicago. And actually, this week, we run guest films every night along with the films made by the artists in our program. And this week's guest films are those films from Chicago. So if you come any night from now through Wednesday, you'll see not just some of our artists' animated films, but you'll also see those films from Chicago that inspired the project to begin with.
So you get kind of a twofer.
You do get a twofer
this week. And these are voices, Sean, that most of us never hear, at least while these artists are in prison. We may hear after the fact, but most of us never get an opportunity to hear these voices.
That's exactly right. People in prison often feel extremely cut off. There's a common observation in prison that the walls don't just keep the prisoners in, they keep the public out. And so we want to use our wall, the wall of this abandoned prison, to make connections, not to divide people. And so every one of the films is narrated by the artist, by the incarcerated artist. So they're written, animated, and narrated by this person who's in prison, and they're wonderful, short slices of life of what it's like, and people's hopes and dreams, and also their frustrations, and each one of them is a short little. They're like little masterpieces. They're terrific.
We actually have one that we'll play in just a few minutes. Yeah. But before that, Erica, as the lead teacher, I'd love to hear from you what the experience was like. First of all, what was the learning curve like to teach these incarcerated artists how to make a film?
Well, to begin with, I have to say that the experience itself was extremely eye-opening. There were many challenges that we overcame over the course of the two semesters. And some of those challenges include technical challenges of bringing materials in and being able to create art with limited resources. But that said, both facilities were very encouraging for the goal of making these animated films. So I think we were able to make a ton of artwork and be able to hear a lot of voices from both Riverside Correctional Facility and Chester.
What was it like for you? Because you were so closely involved with all of these stories, and as Sean said, there's some pretty powerful stuff there. I'm curious to know just what it was like for you as you worked so closely with these prisoners telling their stories. How did that affect you?
So I think I worked with a co-teacher, William Wallace, who is a painter, and he also had a background in psychology, and he had some experience working in juvenile facilities. And we felt really strongly about getting the students to talk about the experience of incarceration without literally talking about the experience of incarceration. We really wanted them to experience the process of making art and having that creative freedom to just express themselves using this visual medium and as well as the writing. So we spent a lot of time working on the stories and getting them to express, and we wanted to create a safe environment for them to be able to feel comfortable enough to do that.
Did you find yourself taking those stories home with you at night, sort of thinking about, you know, these situations, because they talked about the regrets that they have? missing their families, things like that. I imagine that you must have spent a lot of time thinking about that.
Yes. It's definitely very impactful on a personal level. I had mentioned during the opening night that as a teacher, you learn to detach from students. You get to know them after a while, and then after the semester is done, you let go and you detach. And that was very difficult for me as a teacher in this example or this environment, that I was not able to let the students go off and find jobs. And so that was a challenge.
Stayed with you. I mentioned that we have a clip from one of them, and this, I believe, is Brian. It's called Dear Time. Let's take a listen, and then we'll talk about it.
Dear Time, how have you been? Me, I'm fine. But as I sit and write this letter, I reflect back on your words. Time heals all wounds. But did it heal the hurt and pain that I have caused by my ignorance? How can it heal the hurt of two daughters? How can it heal the heart of a father? How can I get missed moments, first steps, first days of school, dance recitals, art displays? Man, I wish I could buy you back. But I thank you because all that I have lost has given me much gratitude and much appreciation. And I value how important you are to me. You showed me how to enjoy every precious moment. I didn't understand, or should I say, know my value until I actually lost you. During my moment of loss, you gave me much guidance and showed me how much potential I had. I am forever grateful to you. Thank you, John.
Sean Kelly, that is powerful.
It gets me every time. That's Brian's work. The Department of Corrections has asked us, and by the way, the Department of Corrections has been extraordinarily helpful, open-hearted, generous partners in this project. They've asked us not to use the filmmakers' last names. But you can actually hear, if you listen for it, you can hear the echo of the room. Our wonderful team from Greenhouse Media, Matt Sulubin, Aaron Eigler, put yoga mats all around the room trying to dampen the echo, but you can still hear it. If all the voiceovers have that quality, it was recorded in a cinder block room because it's inside of a prison, and you can still, that's not an effect that's been added. That echo is the sound of the room where those voiceovers were recorded.
It's almost more powerful to just hear the audio. I think hearing, you know, the singing of Happy Birthday and the ticking of the clock, in some ways it's even more powerful to just hear the audio.
Yeah, but you miss the images. Brian wrote out verses from the Quran. He's a very devoted Muslim, and he wrote out verses of the Quran about time that appear. And you miss the photographs of his daughters, which is really something that. So the soundtrack stand alone. They were created first, and they're very, very powerful. All the week one films, by the way, are on our website. So Erica and Matt and Aaron and William and the team are still working. We're still on deadline to get with the week two films finished. All of them are finished in draft, but we're going back. In fact, Matt is in the prison right now this morning showing the guys who worked, whose films are up next week, the final drafts to make sure that they sign off in there, because all the post-production has to happen outside of the prison because it's all done on computers. So Matt and Aaron and Erica and William are going back in and making sure multiple drafts, you know, the guys can see multiple drafts of these films. But all the week one films are on our website now. So if you can't make it to Eastern State, you can go to hiddenlives.org. Sorry for the shameless plug.
No, that's all right. Hiddenlives.org.
But the films are there now, including actually Brian's film is not week one, so it's not there yet. But there's our five films from week one are there now.
So the films are compelling in themselves to just hear these stories, but Eastern State Penitentiary wants them to do more than just sort of expose people to the lives of individual prisoners. This is about advancing the conversation around criminal justice reform. Talk about that.
We rewrote our mission statement last year to put criminal justice reform at the center of what we do, the interpretation of criminal justice reform, because Eastern State Penitentiary was the flagship prison built around prison reform in the 1820s. The prison was built with this enormous optimism, Eastern State Penitentiary was, and it impacted, changed the whole discussion worldwide about what prisons should be doing, making a shift towards reform, towards rehabilitation. And so we rewrote our mission statement last year to say that is central to what we do. And so we've built an exhibit about mass incarceration that's won a bunch of awards. I mentioned earlier that we seek out people who've been incarcerated to join our education team. You know, wouldn't necessarily know it, but sometimes if you're taking a tour of Eastern State Penitentiary, it's possible that your tour guide will just put the history into context of incarceration today, because it's not all of our guides have been incarcerated, but some have. So it's what we do. And we think that criminal justice reform is the civil rights issue of our generation. And we think with 2.2 million people behind bars in this country with the highest rate of incarceration in the world, the nation needs a national prison museum, and it doesn't have one. And one day it occurred to us, if there is one, it's us. I mean, we take this work very, very seriously. And so we've partnered with law enforcement in the past. We've partnered with victims' advocates groups. For this project, we wanted to bring the voices of people who are currently incarcerated to the center of the conversation, their literal voices. And so every night while the films are being projected, there's breaks in the films. And during those breaks, inside of the coffee shop where the film projector is, we have guests. Tonight it's the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Our old friends from the Pennsylvania Prison Society are our guests tonight at 7:40. Tomorrow night is the son of one of the filmmakers who's going to be playing guitar. One of the filmmakers' film, Justino, his film is basically just a love letter to his family and to his son, who's a musical prodigy. Well, tomorrow night at 7:40, his son, Justin, is going to come in and play guitar for us. And so we're trying to bring these voices out and center these conversations for this month around the literal voices of people who are incarcerated. Because it's an experience that, although we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, so few of us have ever been inside of a prison and really spent time talking to someone who's been incarcerated. And so we think it's a critical element of the conversation that we're focusing on this month.
And part of this will include victims' rights advocates as well. Is that right?
That's right. We have someone from several groups. We have law enforcement. Blanche Carney, our commissioner of prisons, is one of our guests. We have the victims' advocate office. Jennifer Storm is coming in one of the nights. If you look again on hiddenlives.org, if you click any date, it'll tell you not just who the films are made by that evening, but also tell you the guests. And there's different guests every evening. And also hands-on activities. You can write letters to the filmmakers and leave them, and we'll deliver them to the filmmakers, and all kinds of stuff to do aside from watching the films.
Erica, how do you think that this process helped the prisoners as they told their stories?
I think having programs like this is really important for them. To have something on a regular basis, to go somewhere weekly, to meet with a group and to be able to spend an extended period of time getting to know the other students as well, and in that space be able to feel comfortable to express and draw and use art materials and share the work, I think is important.
Add one thing. I agree absolutely with all of that. We consider the people who are making these films with us to be our co-workers. We had a big meeting inside the prison with everyone who worked on the project, and I just said, this is basically a staff meeting. I hope that the experience, we all hope the experience was beneficial for the folks who made these films, but fundamentally, we consider them creative partners in trying to further this conversation. And so...
Yeah, and speaking of furthering the conversation, so what happens after this? Do you repeat it in future years? Where does it go after this?
This literal project is turning into a documentary. We've filmed a lot of the work that happened inside of the prisons. We filmed. We have a wonderful documentary filmmaking team from Ming Media, and so we've been filming the actual process. We're going to film. The last night on September 12th, we're going to show every one of the films. We're closing down the street, turning off the street lights, and we're going to show every film back to back with people introducing each film and speakers and music. We're going to film that night, and we're going to film the audience reaction, and we're going to take that film back into the prisons and show the filmmakers how the audience reacted to their films. And all of that's going to be folded into a documentary that will be coming out next year.
And so just to quickly review, what time, if people want to go, what time will these films be shown?
They run at 7, 8, and 9 o'clock. They cycle about 40 minutes of films a week, and they cycle three times a night, and every week they change. So every Thursday we got a new set of films that runs for the next week.
And the website again?
HiddenLives.org.
HiddenLives.org. The project is Hidden Lives Illuminated. Sean Kelly, I want to thank you so much. Sean is the lead on this project from the Eastern State Penitentiary. Erica Tsuchiya is the lead teaching artist for the project. I want to thank both of you for coming in and sharing this project with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our producers have been John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen, and Debbie Builder. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, and you have been listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup.